Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, November 8th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with our colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Genter. Good morning, Ethan.
Morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Eve Zuckoff from WCAI. We'll speak with Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard Times, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent. We'll check in with Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette, and we'll hear from WCAI's Sarah Mises-Tan. And now a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands and South Coast. Ethan, at least four Cape towns have been subpoenaed for information around their agreements with marijuana companies. Tell us who's issued the subpoenas and what's the sense about what they're looking for here.
Yeah, so it's the U.S. Attorney's Office, and they have sent subpoenas to at least Wellfleet, Mashpee, Eastham, and Provincetown. So it's over these, they're called host community agreements, between the towns and marijuana establishments, places like a dispensary or something like that. So whenever a shop opens, they need, or before they even open, to open, you need to get an agreement with the town that you're trying to open in. That kind of lays out the rules of the road, the agreements between kind of security measures, hours, and stuff like that. Usually it also includes money. And the kind of ideal here is it's people are saying, or people are kind of guessing, that the U.S. Attorney's Office is sending these out after what happened in Fall River with the mayor, who was arrested for allegedly extorting companies.
So that's the mayor, Jaisal Curaiti, former mayor, we should say, because he's now
in
he just lost in the election, and he's facing charges on, and as you say, extorting marijuana companies for the chance really to set up shop in the city of Fall River. And now these subpoenas are, what kinds of things are they looking for from the towns, and what kind of burden is this going to be for towns, you say, Wellfleet, Mashpee, Eastham, Provincetown?
So they're basically asking for anything around these agreements, early drafts of them, whatever they have now, any communications between towns and companies who are trying to set up shop. A couple towns said it's going to be hard because there's a lot of documents. Like Wellfleet has five host community agreements. So you're thinking every iteration, every email sent, that's a lot to kind of go through, especially for a small town like Wellfleet. For Eastham, actually, it's not going to be that hard because one of the shops, funnily enough, asked for a lot of this similar information from its competitors because these are all public documents, which is kind of weird that they're subpoenaing things that you can ask for normally. So Eastham already had to compile most of this stuff for a public records request by one of the companies trying to make sure they have the total lay of the land.
For some of these marijuana businesses, they've kind of pushed back a little bit here on these host community agreements themselves, particularly, I think, the monetary component. A lot of these agreements have money component of the retailers paying the town or coming up with funds for the town.
Yeah, so state law lays out that you can specifically ask for, it's called a community impact fee, which is up to 3% of the company's gross sales in the first 5 years that they're open. It should be important to note that there are no recreation places open on the Cape at the moment. There's one medical.
And there's one recreational in Wareham, and there's one now on Nantucket, but none on the Cape itself.
Correct, yeah. Like you said, they're not as much on the Cape, but there have seemed to be some instances where towns are basically kind of asking for the world, from these companies, and these companies don't have a lot of, unless you don't want to do business, it's kind of hard to go to the town board and say, well, no, we won't supply that. Some of the examples of stuff that people have asked for here on the Cape, Brewster has asked for a $25,000 annual community benefit payment. There's been asked for local charity donations, donations into funds that will then go to charities. Provincetown asked for 100 hours of community service. I mean, another thing in these agreements that is kind of unique to our community is Provincetown is actually required businesses to stay open year round. You can get like a month, I think, period to be closed, but that's something kind of unique out here.
Let's move on. I want to talk about Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant, which was back in the news a couple of times over the past week or so. The federal agency that oversees nuclear plants has said that Pilgrim can reduce the size of its emergency planning zone. And this decision quickly drew a lot of criticism from Cape politicians and watchdogs.
Yeah, absolutely. So for people out there who aren't up on their nuclear lingo, an emergency planning zone is something that was established in 1978. And it basically kind of gives this 10-mile radius zone where you have to kind of have plans for accidents, incidents, anything that could kind of go wrong with reactors. And so people were really pushing back because this 10-mile radius got pushed down from 10 miles around the plant, which that encompasses Plymouth, Kingston, Carver, I think Duxbury, and Marshfield. So it kind of goes down from this very large area to just the Pilgrim property line, which is obviously much smaller.
And this has to do with the fact that the Pilgrim plant has just changed hands, right? It's gone over to this new company, Holtec, and it's gone, I guess it really has to do with the fact that it's closed down. And it closed down May 31st, and now it's, because it's no longer operating, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is the federal agency overseeing this, says that it's not as much of a safety hazard.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so the commission said they're kind of satisfied with how Holtec is kind of has safety precautions in place. They're satisfied with the spent fuel pools and other safety measures. But as almost always with Pilgrim, a lot of people are still worried. Senator Markey and Senator Warren both came out against this. State Senator DeMacedo has come out against it. So you have both sides of the party line there. So yeah, it does have a lot of people concerned, as well as watchdogs who are still worried that, a lot of people are worried with Holtec not having tons of experience in decommissioning a power plant.
This sort of touches on the other story that came out this week, which is about the state's attorney general filing a motion in appeals court and pushing back against the decision to let this company, Holtec, come in and try to decommission the plant. And she's got concerns about this.
Yeah, she filed an appeal in, like you said, in U.S. court, district court, or appeals court, actually, trying to stop this transfer until kind of more things are figured out and making sure that Holtec is able to handle this operation. The NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, hasn't really been on board with those arguments. They've kind of been letting Holtec go about their business here.
NRC hasn't really even said anything. I think that it's almost like they keep saying, well, it's in litigation, so we can't respond. But Maura Healey has been pushing hard and trying to up the game to get the courts to intervene, to let the state try to set some boundaries around this or backstop. She has concerns about how much this whole process is going to cost and if Holtec defaults, whether it all falls to the taxpayers, and also even questions about how truthful Holtec has been as a company.
Yeah, I mean, Holtec has been in trouble in the past, and there's worries that the fund that they have set up to do this decommission won't get them across the finishing line. And like you said, kind of where does that leave the surrounding towns with a new kind of a nuclear power plant kind of in the middle, not being totally shut down? What does that mean if you don't have enough money to do it? The state has made, state officials have made several tries to kind of get their foot in the door in this whole license transfer process. In February, the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs and the Attorney General filed a petition to intervene in the commission's review. State officials also asked for public hearings on this, but nothing's really materialized. It's kind of gone ahead.
And Holtec kind of in the end just says, well, the NRC said it was, they looked at our record and they say it's okay, and that's kind of where they're leaving it for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
The town of Sandwich appears to have its last necessary permit now in hand to allow a major beach replenishment project to go forward. Tell us a little about this.
Yeah, so this is all about Towneck Beach, which is one of the major barrier beaches in the town, which I feel like town officials have said, if we don't have a dune barrier there, you're putting homes and the historic center there kind of really in danger. But so this new, they got their final permit, which is kind of a sigh of relief to a lot of town officials. From the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to move, it's more than 220,000 cubic yards of sand from Scuset Beach over to Towneck via the canal.
And the town is saying that this is really to redress a problem that came about when the Army Corps of Engineers built the Cape Cod Canal and the long jetty that extends off of it, really along Towneck Beach, and stopped the what should be the natural migration of sand onto Towneck Beach.
Yeah, so they say that basically sand should be flowing from Scuset over to Towneck, but because that jetty's there in the canal, it's kind of really stopping everything. And the Army Corps is actually even looking at if they should have some responsibility in this issue. They're going through a study right now, federal review, kind of, which could be done by the end of this year, to see if they should take kind of more of a lead on this.
I guess there's no... there's no lack of proof that this is really important. Every winter storm in the last couple of years has produced more and more damage along Towneck Beach, and the town has been sort of fighting a little bit of a holding pattern to try to keep it from doing too much damage.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, almost it's kind of one of those things you can tell the time of year because Sandwich is trying to get more sand on their beaches. It's been an annual thing, at least in the almost 6 years that I've been here. It's kind of always been a regular fight. And this fight for Towneck, they're going to have this is kind of a first phase. There's going to be at least a couple of other parts where they're going to be trying to get more sand out there to kind of shore things up.
And this the big project that we are talking about here is really kind of they're hoping a long-term fix for all of this.
Yeah, absolutely.
In Provincetown, there's a proposal for workforce housing that includes almost 30 dormitory-style units. I did kind of a double take when I read that. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so Provincetown, like a lot of towns on the Outer Cape, really rely on a lot of seasonal workers, a lot of J-1 visas, foreign workers, H-2B, another style of visa. And the real problem is there's not a lot of places to live out there. Housing has become incredibly hard to get, and when you can get it, it's incredibly expensive. A lot of people are pointing to short-term rentals, but this proposal by by a family that owns Marine Specialties out there. If you ever go down on Commercial Street, they're proposing to build, yeah, like you said, 28 dormitory style units, 5 studio apartments, 9 one-bedroom apartments, and 1 3-bedroom apartment out on Route 6. And so a lot of people think this could be pretty helpful. There isn't a whole lot of dedicated workforce housing in Provincetown, which has been what a lot of people have said could be a real issue and could be kind of a canary in the coal mine for the town.
Your article sort of points out how difficult it has been for even this one family to get and retain workers through the summer, and always they kind of pointing back to the housing issue as the big issue that makes it so difficult.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lack of jobs in Provincetown, especially come summer. It's finding places that you can live and affordably live. UMass Dartmouth did a study last year, and it came out and said that to have an affordable rental income versus the median rental price versus the median income is about there's about a $16,000 gap, and owning a house I think is it's around like $70,000 gap. So it's not like you can just pick up an extra shift here or there. It's a sizable gap between actually being able to afford and actually live out there.
This workforce housing that's being proposed here with the dormitory-style units and the studio apartments and one-bedroom apartments, the idea here is that all of them will be basically what's affordable to people who are working there either year-round or through the summer.
Yeah, I mean, they're looking at I had talked to, so this is the Patrick family that's doing this, and they were looking at dorms costing about $3,500 for a season, per person, about 4 people in a dorm, and then apartments running between $1,000 and $1,500. which is kind of the going rate, and probably even a little cheaper than Provincetown normally is. But yeah, I mean, it's just trying to get, I mean, it seems there's a real condoization of Provincetown, making things kind of the highest price you can get, short-term rentals making the most money you can squeeze out in one season. But it's kind of leaving people who trying to work and live there out in the cold. And if you don't have enough people to work there, then people kind of see that as kind of a slippery slope to the death of the town.
And the Patrick family pointing out that if they wanted to, they could certainly get more money out of this property that they're proposing to develop this on, that, you know, they could condoize it, as you say, and it would be worth a lot more than building workforce housing.
Yeah, I mean, it also helps businesses. So, I mean, you're not going to make a lot of money right off the bat, but they're also talking about possibly doing a portion of that, this new proposal, building on Route 6 as short-term rental to kind of subsidize. So you do part of this facility housing complex as short-term rentals, subsidizes the rest of the rents in there. We'll see if that actually happens or if that works out, but it is kind of a novel approach.
Speaking of a novel approach, I want to ask you about one other story that you reported this week, kind of a novel story about how an embargo on e-books is keeping many library patrons waiting for the newest books.
Yeah. So if you use the CLAM system, which is the kind of the Cape Library system across, there's an online portal where you can get e-books and e-audiobooks. And if you're trying to get the new hottest book, it may take a while because two big publishers, one of ebooks and one of e-audiobooks, has put new rules limiting kind of how libraries can get new books. Macmillan Publishers put a limit. You can only buy one copy of a newly released ebook from their publishing house for the first 8 weeks. And then Blackstone Audio had put a 90-day embargo, so you can't get a new title. Certain titles, you can't get a new audiobook for the library system for, I think it's 90 days. And so, I mean, these companies are saying we're trying to balance between getting more sales and making it available to everybody. Libraries say this is really going to make the waiting lines, I mean, could be years, possibly, if you count the 2 weeks.
So one of the things that's in this story, which you reported, which I think is so interesting, is about how many more people are using ebooks and e-audiobooks through the Cape Library system.
Yeah, so in 2018, CLAMS reported that there was 407,000-plus checkouts and renewals of ebooks and e-audiobooks. Provincetown saw 41% jump year over year from last year to this year in ebooks, 35 in e-audiobooks. I think a lot of people, it is very convenient. It's right off your phone, right off your iPad, wherever you are. You can do it. You don't have to go to the library. And then after your 2 weeks is up, it returns it automatically. So you don't have to worry about, oops, I forgot this book, I forgot this audiobook, and the library closes in 10 minutes. So yeah, it is super convenient. I use it myself. The CLAMS has signed on to a petition kind of arguing against this embargo with the American Library Association. So we'll see if any changes are actually made over on the publishing side.
Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. Ethan, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, thanks so much, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Scientists around the world are stepping up their climate change warnings. More than 11,000 of them from 153 countries have signed a paper declaring a climate emergency. Included among them are a number with ties to the Cape and Islands. It's the first time a large group of scientists has formally labeled climate change an emergency. WCAI's Eve Zuckoff joins us now to talk about it. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning, Steve.
Tell us a little more about what's in this paper.
Yeah, so this paper signed by, 11,300-odd endorsers, they're actually a mixed bag. They're ecologists, biologists, economists, social scientists, and the paper itself appears in the peer-reviewed journal Bioscience. And beyond how actually novel it is for such a big group to use this kind of elevated language, there are really two notable things here. First, it's how they describe their role in this warning, these scientists. They're citing a moral imperative, and it's really unusual to have that kind of deeply human term for a group like this, I think. And second, it's the fact that this paper is in a journal rather than, an op-ed, a letter to the editor. It had to really undergo that rigorous peer-reviewed process, so it has that kind of gold standard strength backed up with facts and science. But on that, we should note that the science, the facts aren't new here. They're saying there's excess carbon in the atmosphere. It's from the burning of fossil fuels, degradation of natural systems, and that's increasingly threatening our climate systems.
It's an interesting point that it's not just a declaration they all signed, but it's a paper published in a scientific journal.
Exactly.
So what does it signal? What's the big significance here?
Yeah, emergency is really strong language, especially because scientists are usually deeply cautious, hesitant to make any kind of declarations without a remarkable degree of certainty. So I ran that by one of the signatories and a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Amy Bauer, and she said, yeah, that is just it. Scientists are certain. We are certain that this is an emergency. But on the other hand, emergency actually signals hope. The way I've been thinking about it is it's kind of like a fire. If there's nothing anyone can do, it's a tragedy. You just have to let that fire burn. But when there's something you can do, you call 911. Firemen come.
It's an emergency.
They work to put it out.
It's
an emergency.
It's time to respond. Right.
There's a fighting chance. Yeah.
It's been a busy week for climate news. You were also at the Cape and Islands Youth Climate Action Summit this week. More than 100 students, 10 schools. Well, tell us about this. Where was it and what was the energy like here?
Yeah, so that was in Harwich at the Harwich Theater Company. And it was a really big range of kids from fifth grade to seniors in high school, so 10 to 18. And there was just enormous excitement. It was not your typical field trip of kids kind of rolling their eyes. I mean, there was this great moment at the beginning where the opening speaker said, cheer if you're all excited to be here. And it was a loud roar of cheer. And then cheer if you're worried about climate change, but have hope. And it was a slightly less big cheer. But there was that was kind of the energy in the room. There was anxiety. There was anger. But more than anything, it was kind of hopeful, precocious kids who felt up to the fight.
And they were trying to establish some specific goals while they were there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they're actually deeply in line with what these 11,000 scientists who declared a climate emergency want. The goals that they set were introducing reusable trays and utensils to cafeterias, banning the sale of plastic water bottles in schools, getting solar panels onto their roofs, getting schools to compete to lower their electricity bills. And that's so in line with what these scientists were saying about, one of the key recommendations is we need to transfer our energy supply to renewables, get away from burning fossil fuels. These kids get that. And this was their opportunity to see how they could apply that to their homes, to the Cape and Islands.
That's WCAI's environmental reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
We're going to speak now with Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Brittany.
Hey, Steve.
Brittany, you've got a nice story for the upcoming Veterans Day holiday. It's kind of an insider's glossary of words and phrases that ring with particular meaning for many veterans. First, I want to ask you to tell us about the story itself here.
Yeah, sure. So it was written by Herb Foster, who's a longtime resident here on the island. He's an author, a library trustee, a volunteer, and he's an Army veteran. And he's one of just under 500,000 living World War II veterans out of the 16 million that served, which Herb explained this week in a really fascinating article, which highlights some of the common everyday expressions used by soldiers during and after the war. So that's kind of the gist of the whole piece.
And one of the hopes here is that because these expressions and words were so much a part of people's formative experiences in military service, that when they come home and they're resuming their civilian lives and they're among their families, other people around them may not even know what these words mean or the significance of them.
Right, exactly. His hope was that through this article, he could inform non-veterans and maybe it's in some of the terms you'll notice they ring a little bit familiar. So it kind of gives the background on a lot of them.
Go ahead and give us one of these terms so we kind of get a sense of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, sure. So there are a couple of my favorite ones. I mean, we've all heard of dog tags before, but they're the tags soldiers wore around their necks for identification. And each dog tag was marked with the soldier's name, his identification number, blood type, and religion. And the religion classification was a holdover from World War I. So that's one that maybe we're kind of familiar with. There's Dear John, which was a generic name given to a breakup letter received by a soldier. Maybe you've heard of Kilroy Was Here. That was that cartoon of a bald man with a prominent nose and fingers peeking over the side of a wall. And this was often graffitied wherever American soldiers served. So those are some of the ones that maybe you've heard of.
And not surprisingly, a number of these have some profanity mixed in. Not surprisingly for soldiers, I guess I should say.
Right.
It's fun to read. For me, I was curious to see like what a P-38 is, which I had no idea what it was. But this was a kind of a can opener that servicemen were issued and that they usually carried even on their dog tag rings. And many of them still kind of have a P-38 or carry one around.
Right. And P-38s also refer to these fighter planes. So it kind of has a double meaning there.
There's also something called a ruptured duck, which is a cloth worn, and I've never heard of this until I read this article, cloth worn that lets people know you wear it on your military service jacket after you've been discharged. And it lets people know that you have been discharged. You're not wearing the jacket improperly. And he says that even now he still sees veterans wearing their uniform jackets that have a ruptured duck on there.
Right. Yeah. No, that one, I hadn't heard of that one either.
It's a nice story. You can find it in the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brittany Bowker, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good one.
We're going to speak now with Tim Wood, the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, Harwich's town administrator Christopher Clark has announced he'll be leaving the job. What can you tell us about this decision?
Well, Chris Clark has been the town administrator in Harwich since 2014, and he announced on Monday that he's going to be leaving pretty much effective immediately. His last day at work will be next Friday, November 15th. Now, Clark said in an announcement at the selectmen's meeting Monday that he plans to seek other employment opportunities and spend more time with his family. And while both Clark and the selectmen said the decision was mutual, it's been pretty clear for some time that his support among selectmen has been waning, and he's been working with a split board on many issues. In his most recent job evaluation, two board members, Mike McCaskill and Don Howell, gave Clark extremely low ratings. And in recent meetings, conflicts with those two board members specifically have been pretty obvious and pretty much out in the open. Specifically, Howell and McCaskill have been criticizing Clark over his management of the town's multi-million dollar wastewater program, as well as other issues. After next week, Chris Clark won't be working in the office anymore. He'll technically be on leave through the time his contract expires, which is not till June 30th, and he'll continue to collect a salary until then. And he has said that he won't seek a new contract at that point. And while selectmen begin the process of searching for a new executive, the assistant town administrator, Joe Powers, will oversee day-to-day operations at the town hall.
Hey, briefly, I want to touch on another story here. The Chatham Select Board has unanimously chosen a location for the town's new senior center. We've talked about some of this in the past. Tell us where they're at now.
Yeah, finally, this past week, the Board of Selectmen made a final decision on a new senior center location. They chose a parcel at 1610 Main Street, which is right in the heart of the West Chatham Village Center, right in along Route 28. They chose that as the best site of several they've been considering after their first choice, which was town-owned land off Middle Road, was rejected last May at the town meeting. Preliminary plans call for this building in West Chatham to be a two-story structure, 11,200 square feet with about 58 parking spaces, and the estimated cost of that is going to be about $8.7 million, which is 2 million more than the proposed building on Middle Road. So waiting has rejecting that Middle Road location cost the town a little bit of money in delay. Now a big chunk of the cost of the Main Street parcel is going to be $750,000 to purchase the land because it's privately owned right now. And one thing to keep in mind is this is far from a done deal. There are quite a few people who are unhappy about this location. Town meeting will have to approve the land purchase as well as funding to refine the designs and construct a senior center. And selectmen have suggested there could be a special town meeting perhaps in January to do this, but there has been other sentiment in town that the vote should wait till the annual town meeting in May so more people can be involved. We'll see how that develops. The board's going to be looking at that question over the next couple weeks.
That is Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Now we're going to turn to Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Jeanette.
Good morning, Steve.
Jeanette, New Bedford was among the cities and towns holding an election this week. I want to ask you about a couple of the races in particular. Let's start with the mayor's race. John Mitchell, the current mayor, won another term, but it's going to be a different kind of term.
Right. So this is the first time that New Bedford was electing a four-year mayor for a four-year term. The change from a 2-year to 4-year was approved in 2017 on the ballot, but not by a very wide margin. Only 53% of people voted for the 4-year term. So there's definitely some difference of opinion there. But the fans of Mayor Mitchell are definitely happy right now because he's going to be serving the first 4-year term. He got 72% of the vote, a pretty comfortable margin. So people who like the way things are going in the city right now and how the city's being run are definitely happy today.
And then you had the mayor wasn't the only incumbent to win, but there was a precinct with an open seat. And here a newcomer with an interesting story won election. Tell us about Derek Baptiste.
Right. So this is for the city council. The New Bedford City Council is made up of people elected in two different ways. Some are elected at large across the entire city, and some are elected by ward to represent a particular geographic area. So the only seat that did not have an incumbent was for Ward 4, which is close to the center of the city. And the race was between JoJo Fortz, Joseph is his first name, but it goes by JoJo most of the time, who, although he was not an incumbent, he is a recent past holder of that seat and has served 4 terms on the city council. So some of the people I spoke to at the polls actually, you know, were kind of looking for a change and almost viewed him as the incumbent, even though technically he wasn't. But Derek Baptiste is the winner. Derek Baptiste got 62% of the vote. He's kind of a political newcomer. He, in his day job, he works with the disabled, with people who are disabled, but what he's most known for in the community is community sports. So he is the director of a sports organization called New Bedford Youth Hoops, which runs travel basketball teams, the summer New Bedford Summer Basketball League, and so forth. So he kind of viewed himself as an underdog, as someone who, in his own words, he said, you know, I was just a kid from the boys club, the boys and girls club, you know, kid who people didn't necessarily view him as someone who was going to succeed in life, he said, you know, but now he feels like he can be a role model for kids from the neighborhood. And he was really happy. He was very effusive on the phone right after the results were announced. And I think people who are looking for some fresh energy are excited about having him on the council.
It's Jeanette Barnes from the New Bedford Standard Times. Jeanette, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good one.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. With us now from the Provincetown Independent is Ed Miller. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, with the current e-cigarette and vaping ban in place, your reporter Sophie Rohr went to take a look at some of its local impacts. I was particularly interested by what she found when she looked at the local high school. Tell us about this story.
Yes. So Nauset Regional High School in East Ham, which serves the entire Outer Cape as well as Orleans and Brewster, has had a real problem with students vaping, especially in the bathrooms. Assistant Principal Sean Fleming, who's been there for 5 years now, says that it's been a continual problem. It was so bad, in fact, last spring, that they decided to prop open all the bathroom doors to discourage kids from vaping. That didn't last too long, as people complained about the violation of privacy. But Fleming reports that since the vaping ban went into effect in late September,
and this is the statewide ban, right? This is a statewide ban, yes.
Governor Baker in late September imposed a 4-month ban on sale of all vaping products. Fleming says that the number of kids getting caught vaping at school has decreased by more than half since last spring. So it's interesting. He said the news of illnesses and deaths, I think 3 deaths now in Massachusetts have been attributed to vaping, seems to have had a greater effect on students' habits than even local events. He said last year there was an incident of a student who actually overdosed on nicotine, but that didn't seem to slow things down. But these latest developments have had a noticeable effect on students' habits, at least.
And when they do find students vaping or using e-cigarettes, the response is primarily an educational one. Is that right?
Yeah, they're trying, rather than to impose punishments on students, to just educate them about the hazards, the health risks. And so students do get suspended for being caught vaping at school, but then they are required to work with their families and doctors and teachers to devise a plan to stop using the products before being allowed to return to school. And also there are educational programs going on. Freshmen and sophomores at Nauset High are now all learning about the dangers of vaping in health class. They're given really tangible examples of the effects of vaping, including that the e-cigarette liquid, after being vaporized, becomes an aerosol and then hardens like hairspray, leaving an oily layer in your lungs. So they're doing a lot to try and really counteract the effect of the vaping industry has done a lot of advertising seemingly aimed specifically at young people.
You know, Ed, thing that Sophie points out here in this story, which I think is so interesting too, is that it's also the statewide ban has also led to an increase in cigarette sales, and they're seeing that on the Outer Cape there.
Yes, Sophie checked in with some of the local stores, Cumberland Farms in Provincetown and Pamet Valley Package in Truro, and the people working there all said that there's been a noticeable increase in regular old-fashioned cigarette sales since the vaping ban went to effect. The employee at Cumberland Farms said that most of the customers who buy e-cigarettes they're not kids. They're mostly people between age 25 and 50, she said, people who had been smoking and were using e-cigarettes as a way to try and quit. Apparently now, with no vaping products available, they're going back to the old cigarette habit.
That's Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks for joining us this morning.
Nice to be with you, Steve.
We're going to speak now with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. Hey, Noah.
Good morning, Steve.
Noah, back in the summer, we spoke on this program about a bit of a dispute in Edgartown. This had to do with neighbors of the Harbor View Hotel being unhappy with changes on the property. Particularly, they were concerned about changes to the outside pool bar area. And now a ruling has come down in this case. Before we get all the way there, maybe you can give us a little more background. What was the concern for neighbors here?
Yes, happy to. So back in May, the Harbor View, which is kind of known here as the Grand Dame of Edgartown Hotels, they filed a special permit application with the zoning board, and they wanted to relocate their pool bar, basically what was to the other side of the pool. away from their building, and I guess in the permit application, they actually were saying they were going to decrease the pool bar square footage by about 50 feet. The permit request was granted. There was no opposition voice to the hearing. But this summer, this group of neighbors took the hotel in town to court, saying that they weren't properly notified about the public hearing on the changes. They were arguing that the 20-day appeal limit should be nullified because they didn't know about the changes. And then they also submitted sort of, you know, a mountain of filings contending that the new bar wasn't actually in the pool area anymore, that it was noisier, it was more visible from the public roadway. Members of the public were using it and not just guests of the hotel. Sort of a litany of concerns. Council described it as a tiki bar. There was a lot of anger about the changes, and there was an argument basically being made by the neighbors that the changes weren't really in character with their residential neighborhood.
Now the judge has delivered a decision on this, and it's pretty clear.
Yeah. So the judge was pretty forceful, saying that they dismissed all of sort of the procedural concerns from the abutters. You know, the town did properly notify them. This is complicated because many of the abutters own multiple homes. But I guess the procedure that the town took was the correct one, according to the judge. When that was really sort of the, you know, it was 11-page decision, and 10 of the pages were devoted to that.
He took issue with how they tried to characterize it as a tiki bar.
Yes, this was actually when he dismissed their request for injunctive relief earlier in the summer, but he gave this funny definition of what actually was a tiki bar, saying, you know, it needed to have palm fronds and have, you know, a thatched hut roof, you know, maybe Mai Tais needed to be served, and that the bar that actually was existing behind the Harbor View didn't actually, you know, fit with that sort of characterization. You know, it's not often you get a legal definition of a tiki bar,
yes.
But that was fun. What the judge did say most recently was that the abutters have an avenue to move forward, I guess, with nuisance claims, saying that while, you know, they might not be as, you know, exaggerated as many of the pleadings may suggest, it's very well possible that this bar could be a bother and an annoyance for people in the neighborhood. And so this is going to remain in court, it seems, right now, and I believe that there's been a date set in December for another hearing.
That is Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
We're joined now by WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
Sarah, it's been a busy week for you. You've been on, I think, three different stories. Let's start with a proposal by the state to ban menthol cigarettes. Convenience store owners have protested against this. You took a look at what this could mean for convenience store owners on the Cape.
Yeah, so there's a whole lot of convenience stores on the Cape. Turns out, we did a count, there are about 90, according to Yellow Pages, that are 24-hour convenience stores. So that's not even counting the non-24-hour ones. And that's kind of a crazy number that you never really think about. So
That's right, a big number. So this proposed ban by the state on menthol cigarettes, what could it mean for that? That's a big chunk of the local, you think, of businesses open 24 hours.
Yeah, and it definitely is something that advocates have said could disproportionately affect immigrant-run and small business owners. So this was something I kind of realized while reporting on the Cape's only mosque out in Osterville, but much of the community that attends that mosque tends to be plugged into a network of convenience store owners, and convenience stores actually are kind of an anchor business on the Cape for a particular group of immigrants who are coming from Pakistan or India. And that's something that's not unique to the Cape, but it certainly is a more pronounced trend here on the Cape, given that we are about a little over 90% white. And so it is a significant chunk of immigrants here. When I spoke with shop owners earlier this week, many mentioned how this ban could really hurt their often small family-run businesses. It comes on the tails of the state's vaping ban, which I think you talked about earlier. Many owners estimated that the menthol ban coupled with the vaping ban could cut their store sales by 50%. There was some talk about how some have already had to cut staff and are asking family members to work more to cut down on payroll costs. And others mentioned that if this ban goes through, they may actually consider relocating off Cape just because it's so expensive to live here.
Tell us about the ban itself. Why is the state sort of focusing in on menthol-flavored tobacco products?
Of course. Yeah, menthol cigarettes, it's not all good. They fall into a category of flavored cigarettes, which have been found by health officials to be a gateway into smoking for young people and teens, mostly because that mint flavor that they've got, it often masks the burning sensation you might feel if you're an early smoker. And so it kind of encourages cigarette use without you having the associated pain with getting used to smoking cigarettes, which can be dangerous.
And where is this ban now?
It's currently being reviewed by committees at the State House, and a vote is expected on the proposal as early as November 20th.
I want to ask you about another story you covered this week, and that's about a singular object that arrived in Boston that may provide us with a glimpse of the future of offshore wind. Tell us about this.
Yes, and very exciting news, a gigantic wind turbine blade arrived in Boston earlier this week
by
boat.
Really gigantic.
Yes, it was so large. It's the length of a football field from goalpost to goalpost, I was told, and it weighed 50 tons. It physically could not be transported by road, and they actually had to cut part of the blade off to get it to fit inside Boston's wind turbine testing center.
So it's here for testing this prototype blade. Tell us about the testing center. Where is it and how do they test something this big?
Sure. The testing center's up in Boston, kind of along the harbor. And it's essentially just a gigantic warehouse. They have brought the turbine blade inside of this warehouse. And in order to test it, first they're going to mount the blade to a wall, which is going to take a little bit of time given its size. And then they're going to attach hydraulics to different points along the length of the blade. And using computers, they're then going to use those hydraulics to apply pressure to the blade at different points, and cameras set up at different sections of the blade are going to look for micro cracks within the fiberglass.
So they're not going to like stick this blade in a big wind tunnel and blow wind at it. This is much more intensive that way.
Yeah, sadly, no wind tunnel. It's much more of like the whirring of computers and hydraulics.
Yeah, I want the world's biggest wind tunnel to go along with this blade. So this blade, it's more than a novelty. It's going to have a potential impact for the offshore wind industry, maybe particularly even here in Massachusetts for what we're looking at.
Yeah, it's certainly a nice vote of confidence from General Electric that they chose Boston as the site to test its new turbine blade. This blade was made in France, and so they had to ship it all the way over from France to Boston to get that tested. And there's thought that GE could be preparing to release this new larger turbine, which is a 12-megawatt turbine, in the next 3 years. And a lot of people are hoping that perhaps the Mayflower Wind Project, which was recently approved by the state, could opt to use these turbines. And, of course, this would be great potentially because it could mean about a 20% reduction in the number of turbines they'd have to put in the water in order to generate that proposed 800 megawatts.
I want to mention one other story that you reported this week. We don't have time to really get into it, but it's about how our growing reliance on renewable energy sources like solar and offshore wind, what it could mean for the region's power grid and what happens when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing. And you went in to look at this, and it really brought you all the way to the border of Massachusetts and New Hampshire to this immense battery, but it's not the kind of battery you think about. Tell us very briefly, where was this?
Sure. It's a gigantic, it's an old school battery located on the border up in western Massachusetts, but it's essentially, it's a mountain, basically, and it's a mountain with a reservoir on top and a river that runs below it, and in the center of the mountain are a bunch of turbines, and essentially this battery works by using energy that comes off the grid to pump water from the river up to the reservoir, and then when the grid needs energy, they'll call this power station, and the power station will release the water from the reservoir through the mountain back down to the river, and that'll generate energy that they then sell back to the grid in times of need.
And in the end, it's about balancing the demand on the grid that we're going to have to be doing more and more of as these renewables come online. It's a great story. You can find it on our website, capeandislands.org. WCAI, Sarah Mises-Tan, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
That is our news roundup. I want to thank all our contributors this morning. Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times, WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. We spoke with Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard Times. We checked in with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent and Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.